Good evening, everyone. I'm your host, Jason Miles, and welcome to another episode of This is Revolution Podcast. If you are new to the channel, welcome. So glad to have you here. If you're a returning subscriber, glad to have you back. It is a packed house in here tonight. We have the TIR crew and some junior crew members. Now, some of you are wondering, Jason, what's the junior crew? Let me just bring everybody in. Coming in from Miami, Florida, he is the reigning Mau Mau champion. He is the Pascal Robert. It's a very serious face here, there, Pascal.
Peace and greetings to the chat. Peace and greetings, Jason Miles.
Also coming in from New York. She's everyone's favorite Haitian.
What?
I don't know. I'm making that up. She could be. Maybe not. I don't know. Please welcome the faceless voice of reason on this show, M. Toussaint.
Hello, hello.
How are
hello,
you?
Hello, Jason. Hello, Pascal.
Do you think you're moving up the ranks in people's Haitian ranks?
She's got to do more Haitian dish. She got to make some Haitian food, man.
She could be eating Haitian food right now.
I can eat Haitian food.
You can eat it like nobody's business.
She breaks out playing some compa music, then I think she might win.
And coming in, he's everyone's favorite professor of Missouri State University. He is with two junior crew members. Mean Gene Bajlan.
Hello. Right here.
Hello. How's it going? I'm here with the monsters.
You're with the babies.
The junior.
Zal, happy birthday to you, by the way. You just turned 5 recently.
5 years old.
Half a decade.
Ready to go down the mines.
Yeah, it's almost my birthday party.
Almost his birthday party.
Oh, his birthday party hasn't happened?
No, not yet, but it's coming soon, right, Zal?
Yeah, on the March 14th.
Well, that was your birthday. So what did you get for your birthday presents?
Building blocks and a bow and arrow.
That sounds dangerous. Zal, wink once if you need me to call CPS.
His birthday is Pi Day.
It is Pi Day.
That was strategic by Gene and his wife.
Oh, Viana wants to say hello. Viana, do you want to say hello?
Hello.
Hello. Hello, Viana. How are you?
Can you say hello, Viana? No? Okay. Well, that's enough of you kids.
Pascal, someone sent a question in. They didn't even want to call. They sent a question already. They said, thank you, Kent. They said, Pascal, did you watch the hip-hop documentary from Friday?
I didn't even know there was one on Friday. Which one was it? What was the one on Friday?
We watched Fresh Dressed.
Oh, you guys watched Fresh Dressed?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was in the house for that one. That was an old one from the 80s, right?
No, it came out in 2015. 15?
What did you guys think of it?
I mean,
the beginning was good.
Yeah, the beginning is great. We were looking for you in the beginning. Because they were showing people breakdancing in Queens. I was like, if you guys look hard enough, you can see Pascal with some cardboard and a shag.
Yeah, because you're going to see me with a Kango doing the electric boogaloo in Queens.
Wait. We have another comment about MT. Somehow, how did this start, MT? So glad MT found coverage for her shift tonight at the hybrid Ross Church's Chicken.
This is a you thing.
But how did we...
They have Church's Chicken in Iraq, but it's called Texas Chicken.
Wait, what? Do people in Iraq know that Church's Chicken puts stuff in it to make Arabs sterile? Did Gene freeze, or that's just his face?
Towards Church's Chicken.
No, no. Gene, Gene, your computer froze and made you look so British and smug. I'm sure one of the kids kicked something. Do you guys remember that rumor about Church's Chicken?
It's something with rumor. It's still a rumor.
But do you remember it, though?
Of course.
When they would say Church's Chicken, they put something in the chicken to make you to make black people sterile. But like it was black people in particular.
Sterile,
like
white, people blind, not be able to read, all kinds of stuff.
They, I never heard the not be able to
not
read
be
thing.
Able to read.
That's awesome. Like, can you imagine going to the church? I think I'll have a two-piece with a biscuit. You come out, you're just talking like a stereotype. Vianna thinks that's funny. You think that's funny, Vianna, that chicken makes you talk like a stereotype? Someone says they have Texas chicken in New Zealand. Well, Stuart McGill, apparently, if you are Maori in New Zealand and eat Texas chicken, you will be sterile and illiterate. Mm. That's not where you want to be when Jesus comes, Stuart McGill. The anaconda malt liquor of Iraq. It makes you Did you ever hear those rumors, Gene Bajlan, about Church's Chicken when you were in Iraq? No?
I'm afraid I didn't. I didn't even know there was a company called Church's Chicken, to be honest. I've never heard of it before. Going to Iraq. There's a couple of US chains which we don't have in the UK, but they do have in the Middle East. For example, my first time enjoying Arby's meats was in Istanbul.
Arby's.
I hate Arby's. Anyone that tells you they likes are any American that tells you they like Arby's is a CIA plant.
Really?
Oh yeah.
They do good curly fries.
See, you get a pass because you're not from here. But if you were Marlon and you said that,
there was a scandal in Missouri with a preacher who was caught on Grindr hooking up with young men, and his kind of pickup line was, "Hey, I'll give you a free Arby's meats." What's his name? Gift
Rings?
Card.
Oh, a gift card?
He was a sugar daddy and he was paying people in the Arby's.
Arby's gift card? That should tell you something.
His idea of the meats.
We have the meats, I suppose. I suppose Arby's.
What about the meat heads?
Whoa. Yes,
what about the meat heads, Zal? That is a good question.
Someone says, I guess my teenage self was psyoped. Dude, nobody eats at Arby's, dude.
I don't know, man. There's a lot of people who eat Arby's in the Midwest.
You know what? Follow them around, and you'll find out that they're
Arby's
either...
Arby's known for what? Their roast beef sandwiches?
Gene is over there trying to silence his child and not get the police called on him at the same time.
He's cover the nose.
He's singing for you.
Gene's so used to beating him or threatening him with a whooping, he can't do that with the camera on him.
Gene is too more modern day to think about people. Gene does not beat his children. He's the most caring, loving, adoring, modern, politically correct parent in the world.
Politically correctly kicks that little boy's behind when he gets
No, he did. Hitting doesn't work. Psychological abuse is where it's at, guys. Yeah. Right, Zal?
Yeah.
Although it can backfire on you, but
Well, we have a call. We have a call here.
Let's take a call.
Let's take a call. Calling from a 425 area code caller. What is your name and where are you calling from?
Hey, it's JC. I'm calling from the Middle C. Ramadan Mubarak.
Ramadan Kareem.
Well, it's actually Jezhne Pirozbe, but okay.
Thank you, JC. What did you want to talk about tonight, JC?
It's all right. I think I might have a low-key rant at you guys.
Go for
about
it.
Some of the topics, have been discussed. About the trans debate, there's this weird talking point that come up, like, what happened to all the tomboys?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody is getting rid of the tomboys. You know why you don't think tomboys? It's because you work at home or work in academia. The tomboys are in the military. That's where they are. Nobody is transing the tomboys in the military.
Mm-hmm. So you think every tomboy is no longer 4, but they're all 18 and above, or what?
It's just, sure, there's kids, but if you think that they're going away, you're just not looking in the right place.
I've never said they're going away. I've never said anything about... Okay, I was going to say, because I'm not saying that anyone's going in.
It wasn't you. It wasn't actually anybody on the show.
Okay.
Although I am subtweeting someone in the TR Sublation universe.
That's a whole different... Look, man, I'm... I'm not going to be guilty by association. No, not me.
Is this one of those conversations that speculates?
I'm friends with Doug, but I've never agreed with everything he said.
Is this one of those conversations that speculates on one of the secondary or tertiary consequences of transgenderism on alternative sexual lifestyles? Remember, I think it was that Greg Greenwald was stuck on the notion that an increase in transgenderism somehow has an adverse effect on lesbianism or something like that. I mean, I remember people talking like that. I was like, what is that about?
There's a discussion that's a very uncomfortable that we have to admit that people are not ready to have at this moment about an idea that maybe some people might force their kids into gender identity when it's not really necessary.
Well, a lot of this stuff is new. It's new medical procedures, new medical science. There's going to be difficulties. There's going to be things to work out. There's going to be mistakes, right? And I think that's a really important point to understand about when we talk about trans-affirming healthcare. I mean, I don't know what is the appropriate healthcare issue, but I can tell you this. When we're talking about grown-up people, who are 18 years old and over, and who have the right to go and like die for their country if they want to get plastic surgery as part of gender affirming care to engage in sex change operations, then like that is their prerogative and that is their right. Exactly. And in a civilized society, you know, people should treat them the way that they want to be treated. It's like, you know, people don't go around anymore calling black people boy or the N-word in public because that's just not freaking polite. You might in your heart of hearts want to call every black person the N-word. Keep that to yourself. You might in your heart of hearts believe, you know, think that, you know, I think this whole transgender issue stuff is ridiculous. I don't think trans women are really women. Fine. But why do you need to be rude to someone in public and try and humiliate them in public? Are there cringy aspects of the trans movement? There are some cringy aspects of it. There are some people who behave a bit ridiculously. But tell me a political movement there where there isn't somebody who takes it ridiculously or acts ridiculously or behaves ridiculously. People want to act like everything is settled, science around what all this stuff means. It's all work in progress. We've only just got past the kind of social problems. I mean, think about it. Forget about trans issues. 20 years ago, they were still like debating whether gay people should have equal rights, right? Mm-hmm. Within the system. And when we talk about trans issues, we're not dealing with, this is not the same thing as homosexuality or bisexuality. This is like a different level of issue. This is something that often involves quite an invasive medical intervention, which may be necessary for people's mental health and things like that. But it's going to take time for us to get these longitudinal studies coming out, because we see the medical advice around this change over time. Do you give people transitioning under the age of 18 puberty blockers? They were at one point, but then the medical advice has changed in some places on that. And I'm not qualified to speak about what is and what is appropriate healthcare. But what I can say is that in terms of treating people humanely, I think we should respect trans women, trans men, and how they want to be. And I don't think being a tomboy and being a trans person is necessarily the same thing. Maybe there was a point in history where you would be a tomboy because that's the only option you have, right? Mm-hmm. But now you have an option of if you want to transition, you can do that, right? And it's going to take time. And I'm telling you, I agree with some of these kind of more, let's say, TERF-orientated people who say, well, there's going to be a lot of lawsuits from detransitioners and stuff down the road. I have no doubt that will happen. Because, again, when you have a for-profit medical system, you may end up with misdiagnosis, right? But just because somebody was misdiagnosed and went through a medical transition, and that was wrong and a mistake, doesn't make the entire that treatment program necessarily wrong. Like, if you gave someone chemotherapy for a toothache, then,
we don't throw chemo out the window.
Yeah. So again, I don't know what is appropriate, and I don't know, how we square all this with also the other kind of discourse where people should be comfortable in their own bodies and people should be taught to love their own bodies. I don't know how we square all that stuff, but people really need to ratchet down the kind of ratchet down the discourse, and of course not fall into the trap of hating on people, I guess. I don't know. That's my thoughts.
Makes sense.
Well, Colin, you still there?
Oh, yeah, I'm still here. But I got to be honest with you guys. The crew is very quiet. But for the record, I've been nodding along sagely.
I did a show and I mentioned transgender, and it took a whole different life of its own, and no one was paying attention to anything that I was talking about, and everyone had their own agenda. I clipped something from that show recently that'll go out tomorrow. I'm sure the comments will be filled with nothing that refers to anything I was talking about and more about people's own agenda and opinions and fights that they want to have. But it's still a really touchy subject. Almost a third rail, if you will, in this world. There's a few things that are like, oh, we don't really want to talk about that because it becomes a mess. And regardless of what I said, people made stuff up that I said. It's an uncomfortable topic to talk about sometimes, and it shouldn't be.
It's become such a bad political third
world. I've got a pile of things if you want to move on, though.
What'd you say?
I completely agree, but I've got a pile of things if you want to change the conversation. For another caller. I guess the theme of my call is just talking points I've been hearing. In regards to the discourse around immigration.
Okay.
Nobody on this show has said this, but elsewhere there's this theme about how lefties used to be against immigration. It was the lefties that wanted tighter control because of this notion that if more people are coming in, that everyone's just going to get a smaller slice of pie. But that's just, it's like saying that there's only so much capitalism the capitalists are going to do no matter what. If more people are coming in, maybe not the big bourgeois, but the petite bourgeois are going to pick up some of that slack. They're going to be hiring people. I mean, people got to be fed no matter where they live. They got to have houses no matter where they live. They got to get clothes and whatnot no matter where they live. That's going to increase the number of slices or the size of the pie in total.
I mean, there's an important question around immigration, and I think there's a kind of contradiction that nobody really wants to talk about because it's pretty uncomfortable. So, you know, you have these conservative social democrats, especially in Europe, you know, people like Sarah Wagner, Wallenex, or whatever her name is, the German Die Linke person. You have, you know, other, let's say, like national conservatives who talk about restricting immigration in order to protect domestic labor. And there is a certain truth to that, because, of course, like open immigration policy, you know, is supported to a certain degree by sections of capital who want to have an inflow of cheap labor. In fact, they like having a broken system because they get a illegal labor coming in, and that illegal labor is used to displace, the labor force in the United States, who, if you hire someone who is a union worker and stuff, is more expensive. And more generally, you know, if you have a successful social democracy, you're going to attract, there's going to be a kind of attraction of people to that country, which is going to perhaps undermine many of those social services that exist in those countries. So that is a kind of contradiction that exists within social democracy, because social democracy is attempting to build some kind of socialistic order in a single country, but no country is completely isolated from the rest of the world. And, you know, conditions in one country will affect conditions in another country because boundaries are arbitrary. So, you know, there are like serious issues to be discussed with regards to labor and immigration when we talk about these issues, and just you know, hand waving it is not good enough. Like, just immediately declaring people who are skeptical of quote unquote open borders as being racist straight away, well, you know, they're operating in the world of nation states, and nation states have borders. What do I think? You know, I'm generally in favor of like as open border regimes as possible. But I think it's a discussion that is worth having without people immediately jumping to, if somebody is like, well, maybe we need to restrict immigration, or have some immediately jumping to they're a racist, rather like exploring what the kind of concerns that they might have is. I don't know.
What say you, Pascal and Toussaint?
This is a serious question, and I remember banging heads early on with some of the members of the Sanders team because they were closed borders people. A lot of them were like, you know, it's like, you know, well, you know, open borders makes it the ability to manage the social democratic state, as to Gene's words, more difficult, because what happens is that it allows capital to require to usurp cheaper labor and allows the prices of labor to go up, to be undercut, so that domestic workers suffer the cost of cheap immigrant labor. And I was like, well, okay, that's well and good, but how does that mean when you're dealing with an inhumane immigration system where foreign policy by the domestic state is what's helped contribute to the need for immigration in the first place? And, you know, there was not a lot of conversation about that. And I was really interested in seeing how Sanders was kind of threading the needle behind kind of a closed door immigration policy, because he would come out and say, like, the Koch brothers are for open immigration. And I was like, well, there are a lot of people on the left who are actually more open immigration as well. And it's a conversation, quite frankly, that I have never seen thoroughly resolved in the left. I know we've had many friends of the show are immigration specialists who've written several books. The lawyer, our lawyer friend from North Carolina, who's openly
Dan Mello. Yeah, that's a great book.
Who's openly open border. But I'm wondering how much in line is that with much of the, the current Democratic Socialist left. Gene, I would like to hear your thoughts on that. Well, or anyone else.
I mean, Toussaint,
do you have anything to add, Toussaint?
wow, I'm big on the screen. Okay. I think that people want to automatically take the, I think it was Cesar Chavez
approach. Cesar Chavez. He was anti-immigration early on and was against the Bracero program early on.
Exactly. A lot of people want to take the his early approach and just make that kind of an automatic rule for the left. But I think we're living in a different time. It's just immigration is different now. The stakes are different. People are moving in such large amounts and fleeing terrible conditions.
You know, also, I think when we talk about Cesar Chavez and the Bracero program, you know, we're forgetting that there wasn't, you know, climate migrants like we have now. And the regime change wasn't going on the same way it's going on or has been going on for some time now.
Right.
And the way you have people fleeing. Again, I live in a border town, so I see the people that are stuck and they're not Mexican. You know, they're coming from the further south.
I mean, it's an extremely difficult problem because on an individual level, you know, people obviously should have the right to move where they want to move. There should be, I mean, it should be a human right to be able to move around the planet on the level of principle. But, you know, often immigration can have a disastrous effect on the country from where people are leaving, especially when you have, you know, places where you have brain drains, where all the most skilled people from those countries end up leaving to have a better life in Europe and the United States. And you can't blame them for it, right? Because of course they would want to come and do the best for themselves. But, you know, that leaves the societies which they're living in, you know, without sort of key educated figures to help in their development. So the West sucks up so much skilled labor, and I'm talking here specifically about skilled labor, you know, that it can have a disastrous effect on those countries. But at the same time, you know, free movement should be a kind of human right. If capital is allowed to move between borders, why do we restrict humans?
Dun dun dun. Kind of a theme on this show. Does that kind of answer your question or no, caller?
Again, I could barely hear the crew.
Oh, sorry about that. I don't know why that is. Everybody's cranked up.
Yeah. It was nice talking to you all, MT, Pascal, Gene. I just want to leave with that's just spicy, saucy hot take for Michael Albert. I just think that with the increased immigration reduces the slice of the pie argument, I think that argument is flawed in a way, and that's why dialectics is needed, because it doesn't address everything that goes into employment and wages. And having a word to describe relationships with you. Peace out. Have a good one.
Thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
That Michael Albert show, really, I've never seen a show piss so many people off. I mean, did you watch the Michael Albert show at all, Gene? The second time?
I did. I saw the chat. I saw people going nuts.
Do you think he was that crazy with what he said?
Not really. I think people weren't used to hearing a critical argument that they may or may not agree with. I mean, people get fruity. People like to hear. People like to listen to things that confirm what they already believe. Because why would you want to listen to something that criticizes the things that you believe? That's not a comfortable thing.
Say that again, Gene. You stopped. Your internet paused.
Oh, I'm just saying that people want to listen to things that they already agree with, because they don't want to listen to things that might make things difficult for them in their mind, right? People don't like to be intellectually challenged. I know I don't, you know.
I don't like to have kids.
I don't like it when people disagree with me or say what I say is stupid or challenge my worldview. But you have to like suck it up and listen to it. I mean, people often, again, when it's something that doesn't chime with what you believe already, not only do they get angry about it, but they also interpret what is being said in the most ungenerous way possible. Like, they take the most negative way of interpreting what that person is saying.
You know, I mean, like, you were on that show, Pascal. What did you think of Michael Albert?
I mean, the thing is, though, I understand where he was coming from, but I also realized that when you have ideological tendencies that are criticizing other ideological tendencies, you're going to have people who want to be very, very, they're going to push back. Simply because they're wedded to, like, you know, this is the way I learned it, and oh my God, how he's challenging orthodoxy. How can that happen? And it's just like, it's, you know, he's presenting his shtick, you know, relax. You know, this is the way that he has a take on it. There's no reason for you to lose your mind.
You know, so we have a new program that we're using to cut up little shorts, and I put clips in, and it cuts them into like 25 second snippets, and there's nothing that we say on this show that's 25 seconds long that's gonna make sense. And I was like kind of nervous about putting it, like, oh man, these are so short, but it's been pretty funny seeing the people's response from some of these from some of these Michael Albert clips that we put up. I don't know if you've seen some of the responses, but people were really felt emotional about Albert challenging the idea of Marxist jargon. Someone said in the comments that he's like, you having to use all this jargon when you're trying to talk to people can get in the way of your organizing, and everyone disagreed. Not everyone, but most people disagreed. And that's fine.
Listen, man, listen. Can we be honest that a large part of the left mm-hmm. is an intellectual clubhouse?
Oh, God, yes.
Of nerds.
Yeah, that's what
my book is about.
That's everything. Mean, that's what it comes down to.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, when you look at the left today in the United States, or what exists of the left, is there's really just two options. Either you're in some kind of small, irrelevant, millenarial cult, right? Whether that's a Trotskyist cult, whether that's a Stalinist cult, whether it's a Maoist cult, it's like a weird cult, and a lot of it is just going around online. Some of the cults are better funded than others, and there's that type of joining the left. Then the other type of joining the left is just an edgy way to brand yourself as a Democrat while not branding yourself as a Democrat.
Ooh.
So mm-hmm. you have these two poles, and I don't know how you escape being in one or the other. I don't know how you stop either being a kind of just a functionally a Democrat, but you're like, I'm edgy. I'm actually a socialist, and I'm not really a Democrat, but you need to vote for Joe Biden. Or you're in like a cult where it says, well, you know, Xi Jinping is going to like send in the paratroopers and liberate the United States and establish a people's democracy here. I mean, like, which one of these things do you want to be in? I don't know.
You're not a fan of the Red Dawn China movement?
I mean, like, if it came and they offered me a job.
Susan, do you want to read something?
That's right. We have a super chat.
Mm-hmm.
From Charles Ghost. Let me get it on the screen. Here we are. Mm-hmm. Sorry for not calling in. That's fine. But what I'm curious about is the distinction of the state and government. What is to become from each, and what could be used from each to benefit a socialist outcome?
Ooh.
Go ahead, Pascal.
Pascal. This is all you. It's got you written all over it. Oh, he straightens up in the chair. Pascal straightens. Oh, Pascal, take the screen.
This is an existential question that often exists in the left about the function of the state. Do we need the state? Is the state the enemy? I fundamentally believe I am a statist leftist. I believe the state distributes goods and services and means of production and can help the quality of life for the status quo for members of society. I am not one of those on the left that believes that the state is inherently coercive. I think, yes, there are coercive elements of the state, but I think that there are times that we need to have a coercive functions within a society for it to work. The nation state organizes members of society in a way that can distribute means and services and goods and productions. If we do not have a nation state or government, if you will, how exactly are goods and productions and means and services going to be distributed? How exactly are we going to have the capacity to orchestrate and organize the actual means and productions that we need to distribute things to each other? I don't understand. We have these quote unquote anti-statist leftists, as if we're going to be able to. Well, we don't need anyone. We don't need anyone with professional skills and whatnot. Yeah, I don't get it. I'm not a fan of those thinking. And I know there's lots of theory and lots of anarchist theory and discourse that challenges this state. I think it's all bollocks.
Oh wow! How do you feel about it, Gene? Pascal's over here using British terminology. So
you know it's all bollocks. It's cultural appropriation. That's what it is. Well, let me lay it out like this. I mean, in terms of the difference between state and government, when we talk about state, we're tending to talk about the permanent institutions that constitute the state. Whereas when we're talking about the government, we're talking about the kind of temporary cadre of management, especially in a democracy where, power changes. In terms of whether the state can be used to ameliorate human life, I think it's like there's no doubt that the state can improve people's lives. The state can be used as a mechanism to bring about meaningful changes, to increase the standards of living of people, etc., etc. I mean, from a Marxian perspective, however, I would say that, the bourgeois state, as it were, even when it's doing good things, from the Marxian perspective, and I'm not saying that I agree or disagree with this perspective, but from the Marxian perspective, it is sinking its claws deeper and deeper into you. Whether it's using coercion or bribery, it sort of entrenches itself and entrenches these hierarchies. That's why, in a lot of pre-1917 Marxist thought, there was a lot of criticism for regarding cooperation with the state. That's not to say that Marx didn't believe in a state, but he looked at the Paris Commune as being the model of what a state should look like in terms of getting rid of the bourgeois state, establishing a new form of state. How feasible that actually is in reality, I don't know. I mean, when we look at the Russian Revolution, we end up, Lenin was a theorist of the state who was argued in favor of smashing the state, who argued that the bourgeois state could not be used as a vehicle through which to emancipate the working class. But in practice, the Soviet state ended up looking very much like the territorial bureaucratic nation state that has come into existence with the evolution of capitalism. So, it's a difficult question. And the kind of short answer is, yes, I think the state can be used to improve people's lives. But we have to also, there's also always in the back of my head, the idea that even when you're doing that, you are basically foreclosing the ability of the, working class to take power, and instead doing progressivism. And what was progressivism all about? It was all about shutting down the socialist movement by giving in to certain strategic demands. I mean, the pre-1914 socialists, they were very wary about using state power. Very, very wary. There was this whole debate on ministerialism. It's like, you go for elections, but what do you do? Because, if you're a socialist and you take over the state, you're taking over the apparatus of an extremely abusive system, the police force, the army, the empire, and how does that compromise you in the long term? So I don't have any answers, but that's my rant. Done.
Gene, before you get done ranting, someone in the chat is talking about your favorite person, George Galloway. I think you and Pascal have some opinions on George Galloway.
Interesting chap. Not my fave.
Yeah. Why don't you like him, Pascal?
I think he's a bit of a show pony.
Oh.
A bit.
Gene Bajlan, do you want to go a little further in depth since you're from the UK?
I mean, like, there's some funny aspects. I've met George Galloway, too, actually, when I was at university. There's funny aspects of George Galloway. Like, for example, he used to have a radio talk show, and he would always, like, fight with Scottish nationalists, and he would make fun of Scottish nationalism, which I kind of agree with him on, because Scottish nationalism is the stupidest nationalism in the world. It's basically the Scots were, you know, big beneficiaries working hand in glove with the British Empire, but now it's not cool to be part of the British Empire. They're acting like it's all they were oppressed by the English. Get out of here, Scots. And George Galloway used to make fun of him, make fun of the Gaelic games, which is like an invented tradition. Mm-hmm. People in Scotland play football, just like, or soccer, as you call it. You know, that's the national sport of Scotland. None of this, like, people dressing up in tartan and stuff like that. Again, tartan, a completely fabricated Scottish tradition imported from the Highlands, which was settled by Gaelic speakers from Ireland and who were regarded until the 18th century as culturally distinct from the civilized lowland English, or rather Scotch-speaking Scottish people. And they spoke a dialect, an Anglo-Saxon dialect, Scotch. Anyway, in fact, the people who were in southern Scotland who were Celts were originally Welsh speakers. So fun fact there. Anyway, in terms of George Galloway, he's just kind of opportunist. He's like a reaction, socially conservative. You know his election campaign, his leaflets in predominantly Muslim wards were all about Palestine, and those in
What's up with Gene's Wi-Fi today?
Playing the kids.
Oh, I think it's the kids. I think the kids are sitting there messing with the box. And he keeps getting paused, making the greatest faces. He was like smug British guy last time. Oh, Gene, you got paused that whole time. I think your kids are messing with your Wi-Fi.
Yeah. Well, I think my Wi-Fi.
George Galloway got to it.
I got Galloway'd.
You got Galloway'd, right? When you were trying to tell the person about why. I get it. George Galloway is on like Russia Today, and everybody thinks he's the greatest man in the world.
I mean, listen, he's good. Yeah, he is
bad.
He has good takes on Palestine. I mean, I like his takes on Palestine, but he's, you know, that kind of campism can be opportunism as well. Yep. And I wish he was more principled in his opposition to empire, as opposed to seeming to be trying to just kind of wait for the next opportunity to be in the next headline.
I mean, if people love George Galloway so much, Navarra Media, you know, most people, I don't know how many old people are, you know, remember him from his time as a politician or a UK radio host, but Navarra Media did a very interesting video on George Galloway literally right after I asked Gene some questions about him. That's why I never followed up with you, Gene. Is Gene stuck? Gene, damn. Yeah, I think Galloway got Gene's Wi-Fi. Damn you, George Galloway. Either that or Gene has Toussaint's Wi-Fi.
Oh.
Calling from a 929 area code. Caller, what is your name and where are you calling from?
Connor, let's go. I'm from Queens. How's everybody doing?
All right.
Wonderful, now that Connor from Queens just called.
Let's go. First time, long time. Love CIR. Yeah, I can go on and on about like how much I love what you guys do. So just want to say that.
Please feel free to go on and on. Just go on and on.
Yeah, please. No one will ever stop you. Your whole call can be that. That's totally fine.
Usually the show is only an hour long, right? So I don't want to go over more than that time. But by the way, I want to second something the last caller said, that it's difficult to hear you guys. I can hear you, but I just want to say that.
Okay.
But, yeah, so, of course, I'm just, like, thinking out loud with you guys, but to kind of put my question, like, out front, really I'm thinking about, like, organizing and, like, opportunism, like, not necessarily in a pejorative sense. Right. So, if you're as terminally online as I am, I hope you're not. But there is this meme going around today that said, like, Marxists usually talk like the Bene Gesserit, like, our plans, like, unfold over the course of centuries. You know what I mean? Like, which is weird, because this is also kind of like the classical liberal position. You know, this is kind of what Obama believed, certainly, like, this progressive ascendancy that we're constantly moving upward, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, like, you know, you should be a little skeptical of that, right? And also, one of the things that I like about the show is this kind of, like, willingness to learn from the right, you know what I'm saying? But, yeah, with that, like, one of the things that we've been interested on the show lately with is this sort of, like, a satanic panic sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a sort of, like, analog for this sort of hysteria over trans people nowadays.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And, of course, like, solidarity with trans people, of course. So, of course, I'm not really so much interested in talking about trans issues here, but more of, like, using these sort of movements as, like, a way to pivot to talk about, like, organizing and stuff. Because the thing that's crazy about, like, this satanic panic, and especially lately this, like, trans stuff,
mm-hmm.
is it appears as though, like, these, in reaction to these events, let's call them, spontaneously emerge, like, groups that almost just as quickly as they emerge, pass legislation and affect power. And irrespective of whether or not you agree with their politics, it's kind of astounding that they're able to do that. You know what I'm saying? So, like, first of all, my question is, like, how is that possible? Like, how are they doing that? But then, just as quick as I'm thinking about that, it appears as though these groups are spontaneous, right? And I'm just not as familiar with the history of this that I imagine Jay is. So I'm wondering, like, are these, like, groups that are cohering against the satanic panic or mm-hmm. the hysteria over trans people, like, actually spontaneous? Or what I suspect might also be true
mm-hmm.
is that existing conservative groups are using, let's call it a scandal, opportunistically to exploit and leverage political goals that they always wanted. And it's because of this they can actually now pass this legislation.
I'd like to jump in if you don't mind.
For it, Pascal. Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you for the question, Connor.
Let me tell you something.
Thank
you. One of the things that I think that we very much underestimate, because we're not often in that echo chamber, is the organizational capacity of the evangelical Christian movement in the United States. These people are very powerful. They have a lot of money. They have a dedicated fan base. They have their own media echo chamber. And I think that what we are failing to realize is that, unlike the left, which is waiting for foot soldiers and messaging, they are well advanced in their ordering, their messaging. They know what they consider their enemy is, and they are much more prepared to use these types of cultural war issues to create a political movement around than anyone on the left is even prepared to imagine.
You know, it's interesting that the caller brought up the satanic panic. As I was taking a very short break from cutting all these clips for the show this week and next week, I was in the background watching this documentary for like the fourth time, and sadly the filmmaker said they're done doing press. I think the documentary didn't do well, but it's called Satan Wants You. And it's about one of the early books Michelle remembers, and how that book helped bring in what would later be called the Satanic Panic. And it also talked about a lot of the after effects of it. It didn't get as deep as the book We Believe the Children. I think his name is Richard Beck, who wrote that, a great book. But if you look at that moment, that's a kind of a bipartisan moment where you don't really have a right wing or even liberal perspective. It's the moment where across the board you're able to change laws to give DAs more power. A lot of people think that comes in the tough on crime era. That gets worse in the tough on crime era, but it starts with this idea that pedophiles aren't getting enough time because of judges. And if you look at the statistics, all the statistics said children abductions and child molestations happen with people the children know. And these abductions, while they may seem high in number, are usually custodial kidnappings, which means a non-custodial parent has taken the child, or it was a child lost that was found within a few hours of them being reported lost. So if you watch any of those old movies from the 80s or even the 70s when a child is lost, right, the police always say, we have to give it 24 hours. Like, what do you mean 24 hours? You know, and that's where a lot of that comes from, because kids were usually found. I just found out that a little boy that he's a grown man now, but we used to watch him. One of our friends had a kid young, and he got lost in the mall. That kid is now a senator or a state senator in Nashville. He's one of the kids. He's the black kid that they try to kick out of office. But he got lost in the mall. We were so panicked. We were so terrified. But we ended up finding him because maybe this has happened to Gene Bajlan. He was hiding in the circular racks. Has your kid ever done that, Gene?
Nope.
Oh, well, see, that's what happens when you have leashes on your children.
Briefly missing, but he wasn't actually missing.
Right. But that's when you look at those numbers for missing children, and this became an official statistic. It was in the millions.
Well, I mean, this is – yeah, go ahead, Jason. Sorry.
And it didn't come out that, well, of those millions, 99% are found.
Right?
But the number got scary, and then there was a couple large cases. Kevin Collins, Steven Stainer, and Adam Walsh. That's three cases. There's not that many we can name of kids that really did get killed or did get caught up in weird sex cults to institute a panic. It only takes one kid saying, maybe this transitioning thing wasn't the right thing, like Gene said earlier, for people to go, See, I knew it was all a bunch of bullshit. And that panic then becomes bipartisan. If you listen to conservative radio or watch conservative television when they talk about stuff like this, it's not a bunch of Bible thumpers. It's a lot more people that we would call maybe liberal as well on this subject. So it does become really scary. And I don't think people have a short memory. And I think we look back at the satanic panic as oh, well, that was that thing for those people, and this will never happen again. It's like, I don't know, man.
I mean, I think to speak to
It's interesting, right? Because, like, first of all, like, that transition to satanic panic to this hysteria over trans people, and specifically, like, it's not different from the pedophilic question, right? Because basically, these conservatives think that all trans people are pedophiles, really. But it's interesting then, like, why the trans hysteria is situated really as a conservative thing, right? Mm-hmm. So it's bipartisan to a conservative thing.
I mean, yeah. it's super. It's
like
it's
there. Sorry, you're gonna say something?
Yeah, I was going to just jump in and say there's a couple of things to your question at the beginning. Firstly, like, these people do, like you said, they are organized. They have local networks. They have local politics. They have the church. But it's not just the church. You know, you have, you know, these groups that appear, you know, there are in every small town in America, you have people who finance conservative causes, right? It's a, you know, there's money in this thing, and you can find people who are willing to spend money on conservative causes. For example, there's a woman running here in Springfield on the school board. They've read their PAC has $250,000 for a school board. For a school board race. So there's a lot of money here, and money can transform sentiment into organizational force. And organizational force can change laws. So very quickly, you might get some kind of, you know, conservatives will be looking for the next wedge issue, just as liberals are looking for the next cause celeb, and socialists are looking for the next, you know, workers' dispute to mobilize around. This becomes an issue for them to mobilize around. The gay issue, like in Springfield, before I came and moved to Springfield, they had a referendum to outlaw gay marriage, right, before it became constitutional. And that, but once the gay marriage thing became a kind of losing issue, then of course the trans issue becomes the big thing, especially because we're coming to a period in time where there is a lot more social acceptance of trans people. There's a discussion over trans healthcare, and this has become a wedge issue for the GOP and for movement conservatism in general. And there are there are people out there who are groomed by the conservative movement to take a leading role. There are people out there who are opportunists who are looking for the next issue to get big on. And there are people who are genuinely concerned and who get kind of rolled along by the conservative movement. So
that's what happened in the Satanic Panic. You know, you had a lot of feminists that were trying to pass laws to protect women. They found that children work, and you get caught up in the machine. And the machine that they got caught up in was the Republican machine. And that was the machine that was getting laws passed. And you hear people say that all the time. Well, I don't care as long as the law gets passed. And it's like, well, because we're not trying to see 20 years down the road. I believe in my soul, any of those people that were part of that movement in the early days, in the 60s and 70s, had no idea that there was going to be like a line to mass incarceration and mandatory minimum sentencing. Right. They were going to be setting the foundation for that. They had no idea that they're going to be setting the foundation for very innocent people getting arrested for nothing, for hearsay. That, you know, they were well off, but, you know, housewives would be spending millions of dollars on pseudotherapy to get fake memories implanted in their heads. You know, then this happened in droves. It wasn't like just, you know, a small handful of people. It was tons of people that got caught up in this. And we're seeing something slightly similar now. Does the internet help or does it hurt? I don't know the answer to that question. I'd have to really sit down and maybe look at the research more. But that's kind of where my head is at now around this idea is the Satanic Panic happens before we have the internet. You know, take, for example, Sybil, the movie that comes out about the TV movie that comes out starring Sally Field about the woman with all the different personalities that had suffered all this sexual trauma by her mom. That was watched by a fifth of the nation. Right. It was part of our lexicon. If you're my age, 46, and Pascal's age, that's what you called a crazy person. Oh, that's Sybil. It was part of the lexicon, right, when someone was crazy. It's a little gone. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, because I don't know, like, you know, hog anybody else's caller time, whatever. But yeah, you brought up, like, online, and, like, something I wanted to say is that it's not as though that, let's say, well, quickly I'll affirm truism that we constantly say on TIR, there is no left, right? But there is such thing as online left, even though it's not your left. So in other words, like, the online left is opportunistic, and it does exploit the scandal, but that only and always just amounts to canceling people, right? On the other hand, you have people like these conservatives who are organized and can effectively pass legislation, whereas online leftism can't do that, right? It can't exploit a scandal in the way that these conservatives can, right? That's not good, right? That doesn't help our cause.
Not good.
Oh, I agree.
Yeah.
I agree with you, Connor, wholeheartedly. And that's the problem. If what happens when your left exists in the realm of online media?
You end up with drama.
Yeah, that's what it's going to be, right? It's not,
I mean, that's it is a way to the internet does, I think, recoup a lot of political energy, because you expend an enormous amount of energy getting very angry at Anna Kasparian saying things about New York politics, right? But ultimately, does that really matter? Like, is it even? Sometimes people get angry at people. Even I'm like, why are you even angry at them? Like, what do you expect Joanne Weed to be saying? She's on MSNBC.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, can you believe the mainstream? You know, someone's like, I can't believe the BBC is whitewashing war crimes. I'm like, is that the job of public broadcasters, to whitewash war crimes? I'm like, I mean, yes. That's why you have a public broadcaster, right? To whitewash your war crimes. So, you know, there's a lot of, a lot of people get, there's a lot of energy being expended at getting angry at just the wrong people and spending a lot of emotional energy on that. I mean, my general tendency is, I think, you know, when we talk about left-wing politics, talking about left-wing politics on a national level is millenarianism, or it's like, it's just pointless. It's fantasy and things like that. It's fun and I engage in it, but you know, really, I guess the only real quote unquote radical politics that could be done is at a local level. I don't think it's can be done on a national level, not for any metaphysical reason, but there's just no infrastructure for it, and you have to build an infrastructure on it. Conservative politics and liberal politics are both successful because they're both local, but they have this strong local infrastructure.
Yeah.
Whether that is, you know, the Republicans, they have this strong local infrastructure made up of like businessmen, churches, the Chamber of Commerce, et cetera, et cetera. And then the Democrats have their own things, you know, professional associations, lawyers, universities. These are all Democratic Party controlled institutions. So they have these huge institutions.
You know, it's interesting, right? Because like, you're obviously right. But you know, like, I'm trying to like think of like, because one of the things that like ire, like conservatives, like it just kills them, right? They're just like not cool. Right, like they're just not cool. Like, and the thing is that like leftists pretty much dominate online space. You know, they really set like the cultural sort of sensibility of like how you operate online. And of course, when a scandal emerges, they kind of like have a stronger say of how it is that scandal is perceived. Right. And basically, what I'm like trying to suggest is that's something that could be exploited if there were leftist organizations. Right. So, in other words, like that is a tool that we have that conservatives really don't. And yeah, of course, the problem is like we can't have our politics reduced to online discourse, but rather wielding online discourse to support a leftist organization.
That's true, but we have to have an organization in the first place to advocate for. That we're an intelligentsia, you know, like the socialist intelligentsia is an intelligentsia without a party and without a party to discipline it. So, you know, intelligentsias are going to do what intelligentsias always do. Join weird cults, talk endlessly like I do, get into culture war stuff or what have you. Because ultimately, there's no anchor of left-wing politics. There's no institutional basis for left-wing politics. There's no sociological kind of element of society that is going to fund, support, and sustain this politics. And as Pascal always says, there are leftists. I mean, the same is true, certainly, on the radical right as well. There's no fascists out there. We live in a world without fascists, without fascism, and leftists. Without leftism, even if someone like Trump is in his heart a fascist, which I think he's just like a complete narcissistic opportunist, not that that's any better, but it's like, even if he was a fascist, you know, you have all these fascistic leaders in Europe coming to power, but they don't really overthrow democracy anymore, because why do they even need to bother? Like, it's just things are very different these days. So everything gets recuperated into the freaking neoliberal grist machine in the end. And that's my deepest concern. Like you say, stuff like the media could, you know, online media could be really useful, but but it can only be useful in the context of a movement to support. Whereas at the moment, it's just hobbyism. I mean, this is what I'm doing as a hobby. Jason is making a living off it. That's a different thing. But this is not something sustained by movement.
Connor, thank you very much for your call. We're going to have to move on as we have a whole bunch of people to get through before we go to the champagne room. That call again, Connor. Appreciate your call.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Connor.
I like that call.
Good call.
That's a good call. Rack 'em. You know who that is.
When will we have Reed? Who's Reed Kane?
I don't know, but I know Sutter Kane. Anyone that knows Sutter Kane is a real deal horror fan, if you know who Sutter Kane is. MT, you want to push the next call through?
Yes, please.
And I hate to say this. We're going to have to make it quick, as Jean and Pascal don't have long. I mean, they have long to live.
Do we have a specific?
They don't have long. They can't stay long on the show. I'll rephrase that. They can't stay long on the show. I don't think either one is going to join us for the champagne room. But I just want to get that out there. Deshaun, did you push call through?
I'm going to throw the baby around.
Oh, okay. Calling from a 541 area code. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Can y'all hear me?
Yes.
Okay, cool. So this is Margo Sorn, and I'm calling from Eugene, Oregon.
Hell yeah.
And yeah. Nice. I like that response, even though I don't know why it was so enthusiastic. But that's a joke.
Because it wasn't Portland.
Do you live in Portland?
No. I live in Mexico.
Oh, I see. Nice. Well, should I posit my question?
Shoot.
Go for it.
Nice. Okay. I also should say, sorry, I think I must have misheard part of what you responded to my response. I'm sorry if that was awkwardness. My hearing / word interpretation, I don't know what the word for that is a little bit off sometimes. So I didn't pick up exactly what you were saying. But anyway, So I heard your conversation with, I forget what his name is, but from What is Politics. And I've been following What is Politics for a long time. I thought he was a really good source of information on, I guess, politics in general. And I don't know. I guess I heard a conversation between the two of you about, I'm trying to remember what the video title was, but I know that part of it centered around, what was it? I'm trying to think. I can't remember the video title, but I know that part of me was thinking, like, I know there's this idea of so-called class reductionism. Okay. And when I was listening to y'all, I was like, I really, you know, I wasn't sure about what to make of what y'all were saying concerning certain aspects of things. So yeah, the purpose of my call is just to ask questions about, like, class reductionism in relative to, I guess, intersectionality specifically, because intersectionality is such a, I guess, hot topic, or it's like something that is very prominent in a lot of so-called leftist discourse. I don't know how else to put it, but yeah, I hope that makes some kind of sense.
Gene Bajlan has to go. Thank you, Gene, for hanging out with us. Daddy duties as usual. What is Politics? I'm trying to, that sounds familiar. Do you know the name of the person on What is
Politics? What is Politics?
I don't remember that show.
I don't remember. I'm pretty sure he's bald or he has a mohawk.
But we were talking about class reduction. Pascal, you want to talk about class reductionism and intersectionality? I feel like I've been walking that plank for a minute now.
I mean, class reductionism is the notion that
because I certainly don't mean to. That's the thing. When I was listening to the two of you talking, I was like, I could see someone, you know, I guess interpreting it as class reductionism. Yet I wonder whether it really was class reductionism. I guess I just think there. It seems like there's either some kind of disconnect or. I forget what the word is, where there's like oppositional assumptions in each thing between class politics and intersectionality. I guess I'm wondering, sounded like you were talking. Yeah.
I would ask this question. What is intersectionality to you?
Okay, so sure, I will answer that. And I will also say, I mean, that's partially my question to you even. I didn't posit it as such, but that was my question to you also. But I would say intersectionality is a understanding or framework of the world in which we understand that there is a, I guess, I don't know, based on your specific characteristics, based on, you know, class, race, gender, and or sex, ethnicity, nationality, et cetera, which influences the amount of power you have. That's my understanding of intersectionality, I think. Also ableism, you know, that's the thing. There's like many categories. I think I hit them all. Sexuality, maybe I forgot sexuality, but that's all. It means that, anyway, I hope that was,
I asked that question because I think that determines kind of like how you see that and how you understand power, because I think it changes in different fields, right? Let's take academia, for example, and this is kind of like a real interesting case for intersectionality. Everybody loves to make jokes about Rachel Dolezal to the point that people don't even make jokes about Rachel Dolezal anymore. But the New York Times, since she's been outed, let's say, there's been about 3 cover stories on other academics who have lied about their ethnicity to get tenured positions. No one ever really brings up Elizabeth Warren lying about her ethnicity at Harvard.
Well,
so if your ethnic background,
I'm aware of that lie, right? In particular.
But see what I'm saying? Like, okay, that's supposed to work against you in the intersectional hierarchy. But those things can work for people, right?
That did make me think of something.
Okay, go.
If I may,
go ahead.
So that's what, when you mentioned hierarchy in relation to intersectionality, I think that's where. That highlights what the issue is, because I think some people interpret, I guess, either the consequences of intersectionality or something about intersectionality intrinsically, which delineates some kind of hierarchy. But I think the point of intersectionality is not to delineate a hierarchy of, like, I guess, you know, oppression Olympics or something like that. So I think that how, I guess, culture responds to these instances, I guess, is sort of irrespective to the purpose of intersectionality, at least in some sense. But I'm also, that's the thing, it's not as if my position is not that there can't be criticisms of intersectionality, but that's the thing, it's like what truly is, like, what can we actually concretely say intersectionality actually is.
Well, what's its goal? That's why I asked, like, what's the goal of it?
Well, okay, so that's a good question. I mean, I think the goal of intersectionality is to inform, at least, okay, so let me just say, I guess, so I think a question I may ask before I answer that is just, what leads to the sort of skepticism around the concept of intersectionality. And I can answer your question first, if that is, you know, your preference, but it would help me. I'm just curious about that.
Mm-hmm. My preference of what? Women? Alive.
No, your preference of whether I state what the goal of intersectionality is before my question was.
If all it is about informing someone, it's like, great. What am I supposed to do with that information?
You mean informing someone?
Well, that's what it's supposed to be.
I got a bit.
I asked you, what is the goal of intersectionality?
Exactly. So the goal of intersectionality, as I understand it, is to understand the ways in which various, I guess, aspects of human identity or experience can impact their ability to live full and, I guess, equitable lives. I mean, maybe you could use another word other than equitable. I don't know what the best word would be, but it's the point of just simply describing the fact that people are discriminated against in the world and that this has consequences across various, you know, I don't know what the word, best word would be used.
Pascal wants to chime in. Pascal, I'll let you chime in.
I find this so absolutely funny. My question when in terms to those who are supporters of intersectionality, how exactly do we know that people from these various demographic backgrounds are suffering from the same types of phenomenon in the same way, simply because they make up this identity characteristic? And how do we know that the identity characteristic in and of itself is the basis of their suffering as opposed to capitalism? Doesn't intersectionality require us to assume that?
I'm so sorry. Your volume was relatively very low compared to the other person who was talking, but I think I heard parts of what you're saying, and you're asking what is relevant about these other characteristics besides class? Is that a fair understanding of what you said?
What I'm saying is that how do we absolutely know that these other forms of oppressions aren't motivated by class or other things than simply the identities that are being put forth by intersectionalists?
Did you hear that, caller?
I heard it just like maybe a little bit clearer. I'm still like,
well, you know,
relatively lower.
You know, we're gonna have to do, because we've kind of run long on time. I'm gonna have Pascal answer this question, and have you have to take the answer off air. So thank you very much for the phone call. Sorry about the audio issues.
No worries. Thank you,
Pascal. Go ahead and talk.
Yeah, my main question is that how do we know that the actual motivating factor behind the oppression of these individuals aren't factors outside of simply their identities, but are not relegated to their economic position or their class? In other words, if you're flattening the identity of the individuals as the main motivation behind why they suffer, then how does that not make you an identity reductionist as opposed to a class reductionist, as opposed to saying, well, their economic precarity is rooted in where they live in American capitalism, which for me is always more important than saying it's their identity, because if we realize that capitalism is the ultimate means by which these people are oppressed, then we should also realize that simply trying to target them out based on identity does nothing but actually create a paradigm where you have a hierarchy of suffering within that group, where you have a ventriloquist of a certain category or a class that is doing better than the others, that is simply going to be acting as a representative for the bottom. And that seems to end up happening over and over again with all these classes. Does that make sense?
I mean, it makes sense to me. Toussaint, do you want to add something before we take some more calls?
No, I think that was well said.
Wow.
Well said, Pascal.
Add a way to skirt out of saying anything.
We do have a lot of calls.
We have two.
But no, I think what he said was well said. I do.
That's the answer you give when you're asleep in class and the teacher calls on you?
Listen, I'm producing. That takes
time. Producing hits? Producing hits.
This is me and Kanye in the booth.
Through the wire.
Why do we have such liberal concepts for solutions that don't address capitalism, that don't challenge capitalism, that do nothing but actually
identity is king when you don't have real victories and the only ones you can win are in with the moral high ground.
Because what you want is that you want diversity, equity, and inclusion in a system that does nothing but create a fat back and biscuits distribution mechanism.
Hey, if you have more Issa Rae's out there, then it'll trickle down.
Trickle down?
No, it'll trickle down to where you have 12 Issa Rae's, 65 blonde-haired Beckys, and, you know, 14 Latinos.
As long as it's equal.
Exactly.
Remember that debate that Finkelstein had with Barbara Smith and DG Kelly. They were like, look, as long as it's equal.
That's absurd. You know what that means, right? When you take that out, you take it to its natural conclusion. That means that if we have a situation where 12% of the population is black, and the top 12% of the ruling class has 12 black people, and 60% of the rule of 40% of the ruling class, 30% of the ruling class is white, and 30% are white, or so on and so forth. Everyone else can be a slave, and everything's okay, because the ruling class is equally represented.
That's all. Look, like I said, as long as people get to see American Fiction and what's the other one that came out with you people in it this year?
People.
Isn't there another black movie that came out everybody was so excited about? Fences? Wasn't there another one?
I don't know. Fences was
2 years ago.
I mean, look, as long as the Obamas can make a Bayard Rustin movie, then we're fine. We're fine. Everything's being addressed. The fuck are you talking about, man? We're winning. We got Fiction and Fences. Starts with an F. We're winning. Wakanda is forever.
Kanye getting married.
Yeah, Kanye West is making tennis shoes. I don't understand why people are complaining. We're winning. Tucson, you want to push the next call through?
We're going to push the next call
through. Through the wire.
Calling from a 216 area code. Caller, what's your name? Where are you calling from?
This is Dr. Claw calling from Cleveland.
What? All right. What's up, Dr. Claw?
Dr. Claw.
What's up, man? You started. What's up? Salute, Jason. Salute, MT. Salute, Pascal. Salute, Gene. I'm going to try to make this brief because I know you've got limited time. And the setup for my question is kind of a long one. So I'm going to open with a couple of comments. Number one, thank you for having Cedric Johnson on your show to talk about the topic of the response of some black people, growing number of black people in Chicago to the migrant crisis and putting it in the proper context that it needed to be in, because that topic, specifically the black response, is a quick way to taking me into Sergeant Waters' ism, as in the black race can't afford you no more type, like, you know, agenda. And the way he framed it, specifically moving the crosshairs to where it needs to be, the deleterious politics of Chicago, specifically the patronage-based politics of Chicago with the black politicians there, and how that affects affects the neighborhood, like the whole BYOB thing. I didn't even know any of that stuff was going on in Chicago and why it was happening.
Yeah.
I mean, I had long known that Chicago was a fat back and biscuits depot, but if you just look at the last few mayors they've had, you know, King Daley II, Rahm Emanuel, Lori Lightfoot, and then you have Brandon Johnson, who kind of marked a philosophical and political change to all of that. But of course, he's fighting against everybody because fat back and biscuits is the way of the land over there. I do hope he can find a way to navigate that because all cities need to get off fat back and biscuits.
Mm-hmm.
The second comment I have is, since Gene was here, we should hear this, you probably watch it later. Gene, in previous episodes, have stressed the importance of interrogating messages you hear that are objectively true, but to interrogate the purpose of saying these things. Mm-hmm. And what is the agenda behind saying these things? And closely tied to that is, you know, something you brought up, Jason, to not argue with people online. I think I've been trying hard not to do that in this year of 2024. But, you know, while I'm kind of over-dunking on people and stuff like that, and just kind of being grouchy and grumpy and just frowning at it,
mm-hmm.
I do think it, especially in an environment where you could get ban hammered or blocked or hidden behind privates, mm-hmm. I just don't find much utility in those people. Because if you're going to talk a bunch of bullshit and you want to put the smoke up there, I'm going to give you all the smoke. If you want to hide from the smoke, fuck you. I'm not going to sit here and deal with you hiding behind the wall once you finally got smoke in your face. So I thank you guys for that. Now it's for the comment. Connor had a really good comment. He kind of showed his thunder about panics,
mm-hmm.
And how panic can be used to convince the public into some very bad policy, among other things, just ways of thinking. And recently, I mean, panics could be based on a lot of things. I mean, you know, after 9/11, you had Arabs and Muslims bad. For the last, I don't know how many years, China bad has been a panic, despite China being responsible for so many consumer goods in the United States alone. And then you have Russia bad. That's when I jumped off the bandwagon. When they tried to blame the 2016 election on Russia and not the growing apathy of the voting public, as their material condition deteriorates, as the previous administration failed to confront the forces that made that material condition degenerate. They just threw a Russia bad, and all of a sudden we have a Russia bad panic that, even if Russia does do bad things, it kind of allows some other really bad things to happen within society, and then also with foreign policy. So, you know, that's another thing. But my most despised kind of panic is sex panic. So recently, Stephen Thrasher, who wrote the book The Viral Underclass, had a hot take, I agree with it, on Twitter, where he said he was talking, it was a response to a story where AOC had been working on an anti deepfake legislation that had some very troubling, you know, alliances in there, including this one group. I don't remember if they were, but they were very evangelical, right-wing, anti-sex, anti-porn, like group, anti-sex workers group, that, you know, is behind a lot of this bad policy. And, you know, some people are very disappointed about it because of things like SOSTA and FESTA, that legislation. And there was some also, you know, other things he expanded on. He said, while he does agree that there shouldn't be deepfakes, he doesn't agree with sending 13 and 14 year olds to jail for doing it because it would just ruin their lives. And that generated a lot of, you know, ratioing and, like, you know, outrage response, a lot of trauma dumping about unrelated topics, in my opinion. And people were upset with him about that. Now, I thought he was doing a good job of standing on principle when discussing that topic, because I really don't think that we need to invite the carceral state into a lot of these, some of these issues I think that some of them should be like, if you're going to go carceral, there should be some like, you know, restrictions on that. But a lot of people was upset with him about that. But it also reminded me about how sex panics in particular are the number one thing to shut people's minds off and opens the door. Like 9/11 turned into the Patriot Act in its sequel.
Yep.
You know, there was, on the sex panic thing, and this is the thing that really pisses me off. Like, there's, you know, there's a documentary that's out now about the Nickelodeon situation. It's actually not the first one. The first one was more of an independent film called An Open Secret that was made by some MAGA shit heel, which kind of pooped on its intent, but it kind of got information out there. Now Max is running one called Fight on Set, which is telling that same story about Dan Schneider and a couple of these other guys, Ryan Peck in particular, that were really doing alleged and confirmed crimes, and just how that industry, like after one of the guys got convicted, they just hired him back in and just put, you know, him in harm's way of more children. And, you know, the outrage there is absolutely justified. But I do have a little problem with like how some of these panics lead to not just right wingers going on this like QAnon like tirade where they see pedophiles everywhere. And I'm just like, okay, let's be real. Like, this is not it. And then if you remember, do you remember SOPA and PIPA, the two pieces of legislation, Stop Online Piracy Act?
Yeah, vaguely.
And protect intellectual property.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they were basically going to change how the internet operated. And then Microsoft and Google ironically said, no, you're not going to be on the hook for this stuff. So it went down. So the same legislators that were representing mostly the film industry that was behind all this stuff tried to do another law called H.R. 1981. And a lot of people referred to it by that name because they didn't want to say the name that gave the act, which was the Stop Child Pornography Act. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you know, politically, you do not want to be seen as somebody who opposes a law that is trying to stop that kind of media. And it's the kind of thing that really pisses me off. So where I'm going with this, if you're wondering why I'm talking about panic, in this age where we have a real crisis of legitimacy with media, and you're seeing the big corporate media outlets laying off tons of people, and the distrust in journalism, if it even exists in the current corporate paradigm, is dropping. I think the reputation of journalists is lower than, you know, defense lawyers and some other occupations that are usually pretty reviled for some odd reason. And you're starting to see, like, for example, I saw recently Don Lemon, who, you know, got let go from CNN, is now doing an independent, like, you know, social media base, like YouTube and other. He's doing any interviews like Elon Musk. So the problem with the panics and the way the corporate media in particular used to, you know, really propagate these panics with media, that's fallen by the wayside. But also now there's a lot more media that people can consume and in some cases, you know, fall into the confirmation biases. What do you believe the role of this new era that is, look, I think it's starting to emerge where some of the cast-offs of corporate media are now getting on to the program of, you know, taking on the internet media, the quote-unquote independent media, in this age of, you know, what do you think that impact is going to be on information and, like, overall, like, what this information is going to do when it comes to informing the public of various topics and even nudging them towards certain kinds of politics?
Claude, thank you very much for that question and that call, and we'll have to take the answer off air, but I do want to get into this because I think that's a great question. Gene Bajlan sent me something yesterday where Ellen DeGeneres and Whoopi Goldberg are starting a podcast, and jokingly I was like, you know, at some point the podcast space starts to look like OnlyFans, where at one point in time you could just be a dude in your room doing this and maybe you can get to a certain point where you can make a living at it. But once the Tuckers and the Don Lemons and the Ellens and all these people come in, it does start changing everything. I don't think the small world of politics that we're on has any influence whatsoever on those people because they're just so massive. They walk in the door, massive. They were on television when television was still a thing, so they have, you know, really big followings. And people still look at them as like legitimate news producers, even though they have, you know, kind of similar shows are now out there breaking stories, right? But they have the power to do things like Tucker Carlson has the ability to just go to Russia and talk to Vladimir Putin. You know, we can't do that, even if we wanted to. We can't just hop a plane to Venezuela and hang out with Maduro and ask him some, you know, tough questions about his domestic financial policy. Oh, thank you for the super chat. So I am not sanguine at more cast-offs from mainstream media entering this space. I think it will change it severely. Pascal, what do you think?
I think that whenever there's pressure from mainstream forces or the right to either alter media in any way, left journalism suffers. Mm.
Toussaint?
I agree with Pascal.
You, if that's all you say, I will walk to New York and I will shake that.
I will shake the studio.
Toussaint.
Sorry. I was dealing with the chat.
No, you're not. The chat's over there. We're here. We're here. We're here.
Okay, I'm sorry. What was the question?
Wow, you just admitted. You know what, Toussaint?
I didn't think we were going to come to me. And I didn't understand the question.
The question is, what happens when the mainstream forces as well as corporate forces start to disembowel media? What's the consequence overall? And I was saying, whenever mainstream and corporate forces come together to create their own space for left disembowelment, the left will suffer.
The left will definitely suffer. People who want and need information are going to suffer too.
What do you think about, you know, these people that had big media platforms getting into the podcast space, Toussaint?
Isn't it kind of oversaturated with these people?
Big names.
It's oversaturated without them.
You're not guaranteed to do well like Obama and Bruce.
Do they still have a show?
I think it's over.
I thought it was over. Yeah, it was like a special thing they were doing, right? Like their favorite records or some stupid shit like that. Like Obama makes a playlist.
Obama makes a playlist with Bruce.
Which was such bullshit. You know, you have to. This space is very niche. Tomorrow I'm going on a Majority Report. I appreciate the opportunity. I'm sorry?
Nice.
I appreciate the opportunity that I get to go on there. I don't go on there just because of this show. I usually go on there for things that I write. And I wrote something in Sublation Magazine last month. And I'm going to go on there and talk about that with Sam and probably some other stuff. So I appreciate that. But even then, you know, that's still not 5 minutes on MSNBC. You know, how different is that when you're the go-to black person for MSNBC? You know, how far does your reach go then? And then what happens to, you know, Joyanne Reed's podcast? How many people listen to that? You know,
people like her?
Do I like it? No, I don't like her.
Not you, but like people.
People love people on TV telling them that the people they don't like suck.
She has a following, man.
You go out into the world and talk to people and tell them you work on a podcast. And the first thing people say, oh, I love podcasts. Is it true crime?
Right.
You're like, no, it's not. You know, you go, it's about, and I always, I'm like, it's about history and politics. And you know, sometimes I get to make dick jokes. And they go, oh, I love history and politics shows. And they name some massive liberal show.
Yeah.
I love Pod Damn America or Pod Save Them, whatever they're called.
There it is with the Johns.
Yeah. And you're like, it's great. You know, Michael Moore's got a show. Yep, I do know that. Yep, I understand. Mm-hmm.
Pod Damn America is with Anders Lee.
That's the one that we Jake like. Forrest. That's the one
we like.
That's, we've been on that show. Those are great dudes.
Yep.
Especially Anders, because we hang out with Anders when we go to New York. Anders' girlfriend, Nicole, opened up the live show. So, you know, we moved up in the charts for the audio only podcast. I think we're number 220. And that's not of political shows. It's in music shows. Political shows will never be heard. So those people take up all the oxygen. And it sucks when they take up this space as well.
To talk about nothing.
To just kind of echo the same things you hear on the mainstream media and then double down on political gossip.
Yeah.
It's just soap operas, man. It's just fucking soap operas. Everybody loves soap operas. If they didn't love soap operas, you know, Young and the Restless wouldn't be on for 100 years. Young and the Restless was on so long, like segregation was over now. So much shit that happened when that show started. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
People love drama, telenovelas. And that's what mainstream. And what sucks is it becomes what people in this space echo, because that ends up being what success looks like.
Right.
And that's something that we can't really forget. You know, I don't say this as any sort of braggadocious way, because maybe I'm saying out loud why the show isn't very successful, but we don't really engage in that stuff.
Real quick, we have a super chat.
Mm-hmm.
Dizzle McFizzle. Mm-hmm. Ever thought about doing a deep dive into dick jokes and their origin?
No. Do I want to tell more? All the time.
All the time.
If we could have all the civil rights leaders being with Pog Chaser MLK, and I can dedicate a whole show to that, I would be totally down.
Dedicate a show to the origin of the word pause.
Dedicate a show to MLK's first time seeing a Pog.
Talking about, we can review it.
there's this woman that I know, and we reconnected on social media, and she goes, what are you doing now? I was like, oh, I have a podcast. Oh, what do you talk about? I was like, oh. I just sent her the MLK Pog thing and I haven't heard back.
Hey. Not sending your best.
You know, you gotta, you don't want people to find it and then get mad at you, so you just go, that's what I do.
That's what I do.
So someone says Pog Mafia represent. We got one last phone call. Let's get this.
They've already been pushed through. Caller calling from a 619 area code. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Yo, this is Steve, San Diego.
Yee!
Steve.
I'm going to keep it quick because people want to get on here and talk for 10 minutes apiece. And, you know, this is an early start to the champagne room. I think this might be a new fit for Pascal on the show. I don't think I've ever seen him wear this fit on the show before.
I told you, Pascal, that shirt looked new.
It does. You look ready for the school pictures.
Pascal got that shit on today, man. He got that shit on.
Yo, Steve.
Pascal, you got to talk it to that's the wrong. You have to talk it to the microphone. I can't believe I just mimed that.
Steve got jokes.
Ken says, Jason, you need
I'm just being honest. Ain't it Ramadan right now?
Yes, it is.
So that's why you can't go in the champagne room. I know that going in the champagne room gotta be some type of Ramadan violation. It gotta be.
He can't even say anything, Steve. You got him stuck. He can't even say
anything. I'm waiting for a question, Steve. I'm waiting for a question.
Well, everybody got on here and asked all them questions. You know, I was like, well, by the time it gets to me, maybe I'll just say something funny to get the mood right ready for the champagne room.
You did a good job.
That's where the ignorant stuff starts.
Steve, you know what's funny? People we've lost patrons over the champagne room. People are like, oh, I don't like it. And I'm like, dude, it's the only place where we can just be fucking tarded.
Yeah, that's true. You know, I get tired of being like always, you know, in like these environments where like everybody seem like they try to say the perfect thing. And I think that's why I like This Is Revolution, because nobody try to say the perfect thing. You know, if it offends, you'll say my apologies or whatever. But nobody try to like say the perfect thing, and then you just get a more genuine experience, you know, that way. Versus every time you go somewhere, if you say homeless instead of houseless, somebody trying to ban you from the tech in, you know, certain parts of the internet. And y'all give people that space over here who, like, if this is a introduction to like left politics, right? This is a little bit more relatable than say if they go over to, I don't know, insert any other leftist podcast where they got pronouns in their bio and doing land acknowledgement and shit. You know, this might be a better entry point versus some of that other stuff. And, you know, y'all don't, like you say, you know, because y'all don't engage in some of the more salacious, you know, internet, you know, beef type stuff, you know, I think people who would be trying to get their introduction to the left politics, this don't get in their algorithm. What getting their algorithm is Anna Kasparian beef. You know, I got my beef, you know, with the politics,
yeah.
but that's what's going to pop up. TY, you know,
yeah.
The reality of it is, like, you know, that's what people going to, you know, see. You know, they're not going to see This Is Revolution. They're not going to see BPM. They're going to see Umar and then some crazy leftist, you know, talking crazy, on YouTube. But I do, you know, I think that's one of the more, it's crazy that people don't like the champagne room. You know, you get to see ass clapping white women and you get to use profanity. I mean, it's like every black man dreams during the civil rights movement. Well, come on, like, let's be real here.
This is the champagne room is the liberation that the civil rights movement fought for. Freeing that ass.
So I just came on and say what's up, stupid shit. You know, that was it. You know, I ain't had no questions, Pascal. You know, I'm a patron of this show, so I ain't gotta have no questions to call in if I don't want to.
Steve, thank you very much for the phone call. We'll see you shortly in the champagne room, where I'm excited to play some of these fucked up videos that I've been curating for the last 2 weeks. Thank all the callers for calling in. Sorry there were some audio issues. I think I figured out, but I couldn't get into that conversation on air. It would have been very unprofessional of us. And as I tried to mime it to Pascal, it looked very inappropriate. I don't know if you saw me, Pascal. I was like, oh, you got to get the mic closer to your mouth.
Pascal's like, pause. He's thinking it.
Oh, shit. I found a page. Uh-oh. Hello? Hello, hello?
We're right here.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry. I found a page, and it's called Trash Local Rappers. And it is the greatest page of all time.
Before you say anything about that, I want you to acknowledge this super chat.
Okay. Oh. Oh, Jesus.
Jason, you need an OnlyFans page.
To do what?
I don't know, Spready Gibbs.
No, my brother.
Probably just cook.
I would love to do a cooking show. So for those that don't know, MT is privy to the Jason Miles cooking show.
I am.
You have to admit, it's pretty good. I'm getting it down now. I get good placement for the camera. Right?
And your one secret ingredient that you must have in everything that you make.
What is that?
Raisins.
Raisins? That's still like the funniest thing that person who shall remain nameless said about that. Because I do like carrot raisin salad, and I bought the wrong thing when I first moved to Mexico, and I bought prunes.
And you're like, well, this is just as good.
Yeah. Yep, that's exactly. I was like, well, guess we're using prunes. They're just big raisins.
You hear this, Pascal? Do you hear this? Prunes are just big raisins. Blasphemous.
But yeah, we need to do a cooking thing. Oh, because I made the baked French toast with you the other day, right?
That's right.
And you saw it.
With the raisin bread.
Well, because I ran out of the other bread, so I had to substitute with raisin bread.
Raisins and everything.
Well, there were blueberries on top, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the whipped cream topping. Okay. Tell me that plating didn't look gorgeous.
The plating was beautiful.
Metrosexual cooking, man.
Look, I cook, okay?
Ooh.
The plating was
wonderful. Yeah, the plating fucking matters. Yeah, you just throw greens on a plate and say, eat, bitch? No, I fucking plate this shit.
Oh, you live by yourself.
It's like, exactly. Sometimes I don't. Sometimes I have house guests, and when house guests come, I want them to walk in the house and say, oh, it smells so nice in here. Oh, wow. Guest raisins are just bigger.
Yeah, like, oh, big wow. Raisins.
What are you going to make for dinner? Oh, my goodness. What a wonderful dinner spread this is. This is so nice. This tastes so delicious.
Oh, okay. That's different.
Right? I have to try. I have to, like.
You're trying to score. That's what you're trying to
do. Oh, I mean, if you came here, I would plate. When Ben was here, all the food gets plated. Even if I live by myself and I plate the food for myself and I take pictures and I don't share it. All the time. I shared a picture with Bert the other day because I made. Did I show you the fish taco pictures, Tucson?
No. What kind of fish do you use?
I finally figured out how to make fish like Long John Silver.
Okay.
Oh my God. It's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful day in the Miles house. And I fucking plated these things, and I made this really pretty, like, pineapple pico. I make sure the color palette is there as well, Pascal, when I'm plating it, and then I put it on the table outside, and I get a picture where you can see the ocean in the background.
Ocean rays.
He thinks I'm and you know what? Just because you made that face, I'm finna flood your text messages with pictures of food.
I'll take a while.
And I'll make sure they're pork free meals.
Sounds good. Do you eat pork?
Yeah, not that much. Not that much.
It sounds like, what's wrong with pork?
No. I've not had pork in a very long time.
The joke that I was talking, I won't say her name. I was talking with a friend, and she was making this joke that I'm the person that's putting raisins in white people's food.
No, come on, that starts real before
that. She was like, it's not white people. She said, it's you. That. She said it was me going to the picnic, putting raisins in the potatoes.
Raisins in the...
Or changing potato salad out of hamburger.
We can't blame you for that, brother.
Oh, it's Jason again. He put raisins in this.
Why? You got everybody thinking I put raisins and stuff in and shit like that. No. I just enjoy carrot raisin salad, Toussaint. What is wrong with that?
Raisins are not bad in and of themselves.
I do make mean tacos. Well, born, liberated, empathetic world. If you make your way down to Mexico, then you can get some tacos or quesadillas. Sometimes we do stuff to order here. Raisin carnitas taco. I've never had that. Do you like raisins in your salad, Pascal? Just a regular green salad with somebody put some raisins in it?
Not really.
I like raisins.
It confuses the fruit palate because it's sweet in the palate. You something like a little sourness in your salad.
But like, what if that's all covered and then someone just like, just a little sprinkle, just a little like, raisins.
Usually the salad dressing is a little sour. That's why you put the raisin in there, you're throwing off the taste.
We know Pascal only likes Thousand Island dressing then.
I do like Thousand Island.
There you go. See, that's why if you come down here, how about this? We'll split the difference. I'll put craisins in the salad.
What is a craisin?
I like craisin. Like a
crazy raisin.
They're cranberries.
They're cranberries. They're dried cranberries.
Child. Someone said Caucasian tendencies.
They said Jason in a restaurant waiting tables with a raisin box instead of a pepper grinder.
That's fact.
Can you imagine if you just say when?
And you don't listen, you just add as many risks. I'm just as you like want.
Paying attention to anything else. That's me, man.
Nature's candy.
Everybody's healthy. I just saved MT's foot. She was about to get a foot cut off like Big Mama and fucking Soul Food, and I just saved it with a raisin.
With a raisin.
Well, thank you guys so much for hanging out with us. An hour of free champagne was had on this show. We will be heading into the champagne room. Well, Pascal's going to bed. Are you coming? You're not coming to the champagne room.
Nah, it's a little coming up on late.
Okay. Toussaint, you're going to hang out with me for a little bit?
Yep.
All right. And don't forget Saturday, a great show Saturday, pre-recorded conversation that I had earlier this week with Alex Hockley of the Bunga Bunga podcast. About these eulogies that have been written, if you will, on the millennial left. Vincent Bevins, Chris Catrone, and Anton Yeager wrote some great books. Check those out. I'm working on getting Anton Yeager on the show as well so we can do the trifecta on these millennial eulogies. And also, check me out tomorrow, I believe, at the start of the fun half. I'll be on the Majority Report hanging out with Sam Cedar and my good friend Matt Leck, Emma Viglin, I think. I don't know who's all going to be there, but definitely Sam will be there, and we'll be shooting the shit. Jason's trying to slide to the DMs of the Sun Maid girl. Just know this show keeps me just out of everybody's DMs. They get interested for a minute. Oh, you live in Mexico. Oh my God. Oh, I saw the pictures. Oh, that's so pretty. What do you do for a living again? And they're like, oh.
No, my brother.
Thank you guys so much. And we are
out.